This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I'm your host, Jeff.
And I'm your other host, Kim.
Welcome to episode 31, where we review the Alfred Hitchcock classic from 1963, The Birds. Look for us on Instagram and Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century. That's 202H. We post our next movie selection there. You can comment, give your thoughts, and they just might make it on the air. Well, something we've been watching lately, Narrow Margin from 1990. It's very Hitchcock-esque.
That's true.
I think it's appropriate to bring up for this movie review that we're going to do. If you haven't seen it, it's a crime thriller starring Gene Hackman. It largely takes place on a speeding train. The reason why we brought this up, our daughter participated in a mock trial in the last couple weeks.
So her eighth grade class of homeschoolers, they, our son did this when he was in eighth grade too. They get to go through the process of preparing for a trial. They have witnesses. They get to play defense and prosecution. Our daughter happened to be a prosecuting attorney and found out that she loves this.
Yeah.
And so it jogged your memory and reminded you of... Mm-hmm.
Narrow Margin.
Yeah, Narrow Margin. Gene Hackman's character is the state prosecutor.
Yeah, he's a deputy district attorney. He's sent to protect a woman who accidentally witnesses a mafia murder.
Right.
And he's got some amazing lines in this.
It's a little snarky. Like, he's kind of a smart aleck, right?
Right.
Like, light, but there's some snark to it. But it's well played. And because of that mock trial that our daughter participated in, I... contracted the cold that they were all sharing amongst the mock trial team.
Oh, yeah.
So here I am sounding very nasally. That's usually your job in the podcast.
Yes.
To be the nasally one.
I'm still a month removed from my surgery, so I'm still kind of nasally. That's all right. We'll be the snot twins.
Yep. Gross.
It is gross. Something else we've been watching, which I'm sure many of you have been as well, Moon Knight.
Yeah.
Which is the new Marvel superhero TV series on Disney Plus. We've watched 5 episodes so far.
Right.
And they come out with a new one probably the same day that we release this.
Yeah, I think on Wednesdays, right?
Yeah. So a new one will drop.
Tomorrow?
It's been pretty cool, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've enjoyed it. It's kept me on my toes. I don't really... It feels a little akin to WandaVision. Mm-hmm. Not because we know anything about... WandaVision, we came into knowing something about those characters.
Uh-huh.
This, I knew nothing about Moon Knight. I think he's a pretty obscure Marvel character, right? Like, I mean, I'm not a comic book nerd or knowledgeable about comic books at all. So, I don't know. I've enjoyed it. I'm interested to see where it goes. I like that it brings in a lot of Middle Eastern elements because he is sort of working with an ancient Egyptian god, or maybe the ancient Egyptian god is one of his split personalities, or...
Uh-huh. Or the god is playing him. We really don't know.
We don't know. We don't know. It's really got us guessing, but it's interesting.
I think that's the thing about this show. The whole time you're kind of wondering what's going on.
You never know if it's real, and here's my air quotes, real, it's a superhero comic, or is it in his head? Because I think, as far as I know, this is the only mainstream comic book character dealing with mental illness.
Yeah.
Like, he definitely has, dissociative identity?
Right.
I don't know the right terminology in the psychiatric
world. Multiple personality.
Multiple personalities. I feel like that's an antiquated term, but
maybe.
What do I know? Anyhow, like, I don't know of other characters. Obviously, if you think of the Joker, he's got mental problems, right?
Yeah, oh sure.
But not like this guy's, like, dealing with his mental health. Like, we see him in a mental hospital with a counselor.
Yeah.
But the counselor happens to be, a counselor may be the wrong word, doctor, I don't know.
It happens
to be Ethan Hawke, and Ethan Hawke's other character is the bad guy. He's like the villain. So we don't know what, I don't know.
We don't really know what's going on.
By the words that are coming out of my mouth, we're all very confused.
Yeah. And we think we like it, but it all depends on where they land, you know?
Right.
If it lands still unresolved, I might look back and say, you know, I'm a little ticked off that you kept me strung along this whole time.
Right, and I have no resolution. But there's this hopeful feeling of, like, eventually we're going to understand what's going on with this guy.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
We'll see.
All All right, this is your spoiler alert. If you don't like spoilers, hit pause now, go watch this movie, and come back and join us later. We are reviewing the 1963 The Birds by one Alfred Hitchcock. And I'm going to read you the synopsis from Rotten Tomatoes with a few additions. So we have Melanie Daniels. She meets Mitch Brenner in a San Francisco pet store and decides to follow him home. She brings with her the gift of two lovebirds, and they strike up a romance, sort of. One day, very soon after this, birds start attacking children at Mitch's sister's party. A huge assault starts on the town by the attacking birds. And by huge assault, we mean, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of birds.
Yeah.
Of all types and breeds.
Yes. Pretty scary stuff.
It is scary stuff. I would like to add that this is a 95% score on Rotten Tomatoes by the critics. Yeah. I think it's like an 83% by the the audience score.
Yeah.
But I think the critics know where it's at here because this, I mean, we'll get into this, but this is one of the top of, I don't know, what are these?
Animal attack films.
Animal or horror,
nature
drama.
Nature versus man.
Yes, exactly. That type of thing. This kind of set the bar high.
Yeah. So when did you first see this film?
I feel like high school was when I first saw it. I had an English teacher that was big into Alfred Hitchcock and drama, suspense, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I know I saw it in high school. I may have seen it before then.
Right.
You know, Hitchcock films were kind of one of those sort of obscure things in my mm-hmm. childhood that would have, you know, my family would have let me watch.
Yeah.
So
they wouldn't be go-to viewing for your home, but
yeah, if it was on, we would probably watch it. But I don't think it played as regularly as, say, Beastmaster or something right. like, or a Steven Seagal movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. I'm trying to remember when I first saw this. I'm pretty sure I saw it about maybe the same time you did, like in high school era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I definitely saw Vertigo a lot more, mm-hmm. which we reviewed mm-hmm. last year. North by Northwest was a biggie.
Oh, yeah.
Psycho, I saw that as a kid, I remember. Right. And showering that night was tough.
Yeah. That one is definitely, I think, the darkest of the Hitchcock.
Yeah. But this one I saw, I know I saw it once, kind of in that high school, college
time frame. Think The Birds kind of kicked off a love of Hitchcock for me. I think it was the first Hitchcock I saw.
Okay.
And then I kind of started looking for Hitchcock in other places.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the second time we saw it a few years ago with our family. It came on. I know we were in West Virginia on vacation.
That's right. It came on
and we watched it together. And
I forgot about that.
And then so the third time I saw it was with you.
All right.
And it's on Peacock right now. I can't remember if you mentioned that or not.
Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned it or not, but it is on Peacock for free if you have a Peacock subscription.
Right, right. This movie basically grossed $11.4 million on a $3.3 million budget. So okay. I think it was profitable. The Birds is a horror story by the British writer Daphne du Maurier. And I'm sure I just slaughtered that name.
She was British, but she definitely has a French name.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's by marriage or what.
We're not going to get it right. That's okay.
But yeah, it's from her 1952 collection, The Apple Tree. Hitchcock obviously took big inspiration from that, as well as from a real-life event that happened in California in 1961 in a place called Capitola. There were hordes of seabirds dive-bombing people's homes.
Ooh.
And basically crashing into cars and spewing half-digested anchovies onto lawns.
Oh, that's disgusting.
The vomiting birds.
Well, did they just get a really bad case of food poisoning? Like, were they out to get the people, or was this just like a bad night out for the birds
and
they ate some bad anchovies?
Who knows? Yeah.
That's terrible.
They got a little crazy in California.
Do we know if they ever figured out the reason for this?
Well, you know, this information's from Wiki, so who knows how true it is.
Yeah, okay.
They attributed it to toxic algae.
Oh.
But nobody knew about toxic algae, apparently, in the 1960s.
Got some bad algae.
So they were just worried, like, oh, gosh, these birds went bad.
That would be terrifying. I like birds, but I like birds to be, like, in their place.
Yeah.
You know, like, I want to watch birds from even our chickens. Like, I love to watch them. I don't like to tote them around like our son does.
Right.
You know, I don't know. They have beaks and talons.
Yeah. Well... You know, the reason why we picked this movie, you and I went for a walk.
That's true.
And it was in an evening when it had just rained.
I think it was about to rain.
Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah.
But all the birds just came alive.
Yeah, they did.
And they were all predatory birds.
Yeah.
And maybe all birds are predatory. I don't know. But these were like big predatory birds. Right. Hawks, owls. And they
were saw two owls on one fence, like side by side. Like yeah. They were twins or something.
And we don't see that every night.
No, we don't. I mean, we live in a semi-rural area.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like Jenna from 30 Rock just said rural dr. Sorry.
Rural dr.
So we see birds. We see, you know, raptors, things like hawks, and we do see bald eagles on occasion. They like to live on an osprey, and
that's true.
You know, owls and things, but not all in the same walk in the same evening. This was like weird. Like we were seeing a lot of birds in one walk.
But it inspired our podcast for today. We
it
said,
did.
Hey,
it did.
Let's review the birds next. One thing that we did differently than what we typically do is we watched the first half of this film, and then we stopped it.
Yes.
And we had to do some other things, and then we picked back up the next day.
It was mostly a scheduling snafu.
Yeah,
right?
It was. But I'm really, really glad we did that, because you and I, one of the things we do is we take a walk, and we talk about these films before we record them on our podcast.
Yeah.
And what we talked about was there's so many parts in that first half of the film that I didn't remember the first couple viewings.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of the birds, I think of the playground scene with all the birds accumulating.
Right.
I think of the birthday party, them attacking the kids and like being stuck in the kid's hair and like poking at the kid.
Exactly.
I think of the phone booth, the lady's stuck in the phone booth and the guy comes running up and, you know, she's kind of like, oh, this phone booth's taken, buddy. You know,
yeah,
good luck with
exactly.
the birds.
Move along.
I think at the very end, him opening the door, gingerly looking out, and there's just birds everywhere you look.
Right. I mean, when you think of the birds, you're thinking of the actual birds attacking the humans.
But there's so much setup that happens, and I think it really is impactful for the last half because you've done this slow buildup, right?
Exactly.
And so a few things that I wanted to mention really came up from the first half of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really get Melanie following Mitch for this whole big gag that she's going to do.
Right.
I just thought, like, man, this is so much effort she's putting into this. She's going to drive out there for hours, chase this guy down.
Yeah, so basically his family lives 2 hours, I think they said, outside of San Francisco. But they meet, Mitch and Melanie meet in a San Francisco bird shop.
Yeah.
And there's kind of this cat and mouse game that's happening between them, right?
Yeah, and initially I thought they were flirting.
Right.
But then he gets kind of
he has a way
offensive.
Of pushing her buttons.
Yeah, he does.
Like he's messing with her on purpose. So we had a discussion about this because I think when you look at a lot of the write-ups about this movie, they talk about it being a practical joke. Melanie follows him first to his apartment in San Francisco, and he's not there, and then all the way out to Bodega Bay, where his family lives, and he visits on the weekends, to finish this prank to deliver the lovebirds that he couldn't find for his little sister's birthday.
Right. And it doesn't just stop there, either.
It doesn't stop there.
She wants to know the name of the little girl whose birthday party was coming up.
Right.
And the shop owner's like, oh, you got to go down to the schoolhouse and find, what's her face?
Annie.
Find Annie. Annie knows the name
Annie
of the little girl. And then you have to rent a boat. And you got to take the boat across the lake.
Like it just goes on and on and on. And I say, I don't know. Hitchcock leaves me guessing here. Is it a prank she's pulling on this guy? Or is this like her, I mean, it's obviously flirting, whether it's a prank or not. Like I feel like maybe, because we find out that Melanie Daniels, Tippi Hedren's character, is like a socialite. She's very wealthy. She's very well known. She's very beautiful. So she makes headlines all the time. Like basically her every move is kind of part of the gossip column.
Yeah.
Right. And so
we would equate her to like a Paris Hilton or somebody.
Yeah. But that's dating us, I think. I don't know who the modern day, a Kardashian?
Maybe
I don't know.
Kardashian.
I don't know.
Yeah. They're famous just because they're related to
they're
somebody.
Famous
they
rich
have money.
And famous.
They date people.
Exactly. So he knows that. He's kind of like messing with her. He obviously has read some gossip column stories about her, but he doesn't fall at her feet and worship her, which I think is what she's probably used to.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't just cave to her every whim Like, he kind of messes with her and kind of gives her a little bit of the cold shoulder. Like, he can walk away from her. And I think that gets under her skin is where I took it. You took it as like, wow, that's going a long way to pull off a prank. Like, that's a lot of hard work. And it is. Like, but I think part of that, maybe Hitchcock was trying to make it look like, well, this guy's bothering her in an interesting way, a way that doesn't normally get to her.
Yeah.
A way that she's not used to people treating her.
I think
so she's chasing that.
I think you could be right. When I look at like other scenes, it just seemed to happen two or three times later where they have these encounters and this very similarly, they start off by being a little flirty and you think, oh, they're heading down the romance path.
Right.
But then like he just rolls off question after question and kind of in a judgy way, almost like
there's
attacking
an edge to it.
Lawyer because he's a lawyer by trade.
That's true.
And she's answering them, all of them. She's not like, that's none of your business or back off. She keeps answering them. But as she's answering them, she gets more and more frustrated with him.
That's true.
And they like split up and they're both kind of ticked at each other.
Yeah.
But then they pick back up. Like they're very quick to forgive each other.
Well, once things get tense in the movie, then they're like all about each other. Like they're falling in each other's arms. Like this could be the end of the world. We have to love each other.
Right.
Kind of scenario. So that's, yeah.
But I mean, during that buildup, that first hour.
And that, the buildup. There's a lot of interesting things. And it's funny that you and I picked up on that just because we'd stopped the movie halfway and then had a conversation about it. We were like, oh, when you think about the movie later, you never think about all this buildup. But then as I was reading through the Rotten Tomatoes stuff, the critics' consensus says, proving once again, I'm quoting them, proving once again that buildup is the key to suspense, Alfred Hitchcock successfully turned birds into some of the most terrifying villains in horror history. And I thought, yeah, that's it right there. The buildup is the key to the suspense of this movie. Because everything is slow storytelling. Even when the birds get involved, we're still like you have these long pauses of like birds just gathering on playground equipment.
Right.
Or birds just are all flocking to some, you know, inanimate object. They're just kind of waiting.
Yeah.
It's this whole long, slow buildup. And that's what the whole first half of the movie is these awkward conversations between humans are kind of slow.
Mm-hmm.
This long gag that we're like, why would you go to all the trouble? Like she's basically stalking this guy.
Right. And there's this thing that develops with Mitch's mom, right?
Oh, right.
So we get introduced to Jessica Tandy's character, Lydia Brenner, in yet another Hitchcock film in which we have an overbearing, overprotective mom that really doesn't want to see her little boy fall in love with anybody.
Right. She has an almost otherworldliness about her in this movie.
Uh-huh.
It's almost witchy, like not in like just because she's mean-spirited, like she's kind of quiet, but she's always got this wary look on her face, like, and you almost start to believe, like, is she controlling the birds? Like, what's happening?
Right.
Is she causing this?
Is there some evil there?
Yeah, because she's so wary and apprehensive and like clearly distrustful of any other female.
Yeah, and it's not even anything that she says. Because I can't even think of too much where she's bad-mouthing anybody.
No.
But we find out most of it through Suzanne Plachette's character talking about her.
Exactly. So what we didn't mention is Annie, Suzanne Plachette's character, was at one time apparently a love interest of Mitch Brenner, Rod Taylor's character, right?
Right.
And, but now she's, I don't know, relegated to the sidelines.
Yeah.
She stayed in his hometown, but she's just like the spinster school mom or school marm or whatever you call that.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, she's a cast off of his.
Yeah.
But now she can be friends with Lydia, his mom, because she's not competition
with
mom. It's a very weird scenario. She, Jessica Tandy, like her character is spooky. Spooky is the word I would use for her in this.
I agree.
Like she's just, she maybe has seven lines in the whole movie.
Yeah.
But her emotions, her face, her eyes, she just exudes this kind of spookiness. And we never know, like, is she at fault for the birds? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think so. I wouldn't go that far. But I think there is so much question and mystery around her. Like, even how she behaves after seeing the guy. It's the first really kind of graphic scene.
Right, the first
death. We see the dead guy where his eyes have been poked out by the birds.
I think he was their farmer neighbor.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd gone
to check
on him. So
she runs in and she sees him and comes running out. And I don't know if it's another farmer there or whatever. But she doesn't even tell him, hey, there's a dead guy in the house.
No.
She just like makes these crazy faces, gets in the truck, drives to her home, sees her son, and
like screams and runs in the house, right?
Yeah, she hardly even makes a noise though. She's just like looks at him, horrified, pushes him out of the way, goes to the room.
It's like a whimper or something. She makes some sort of noise and runs into the house. It's not words.
Yeah.
Yeah. She just, I don't know, she just has a very otherworldly character about her. I'm used to her being an old lady. I mean, she is an older lady. She's a middle-aged woman in this movie, but, you know, later in the 90s, like, she's driving Miss Daisy.
Right.
I think she was in Cocoon yeah. Right? She's a very old lady, so it's, I've never realized it was her playing this character and never realized just how spooky she really is until we watched it this last time.
Something else we noticed was there was no music.
Oh, yeah.
And we did a little research on this. Originally, Hitchcock wanted to have no music in Psycho.
Oh.
And you think of how pivotal the score is in the movie Psycho.
Like, everybody knows that. Even if you've never seen Psycho, you know the ree-ree.
Yeah. Yeah, that haunting score. But, you know, he gave in and gave it a score. But in this one, he stuck to his gun, said no music.
That's interesting.
And I think it adds to that slow buildup. You know, that first hour, you know, there's this tension.
Mm-hmm. Well, it almost makes you pick up on the background noises even more. Like, everything is noticeable. So if you've got traffic outside the bird shop, or when they're in the pet shop and you've got all the little cheeping and chirping, and then if you're just in the quiet town of Bodega Bay, you're hearing just the harbor sounds. Or you're just hearing, you know, it's there's not a lot going on in that town, really. So you're not hearing much of anything, but then you hear the flutter of a thousand bajillion bird wings.
One other thing I wanted to mention is there's several questions brought up, but there aren't really any answers.
There are zero answers in this movie.
So even the very end, we don't know why the birds went crazy.
Mm-mm.
We don't know if Mitch and Melanie are going to become an item or not.
No, like, are we they don't. Have a, do we even know if they actually make it out of the town okay?
Yeah, we don't even know if they survive. You're right.
We see them drive off, but we don't. We just heard on the radio like the town had kind of been like sealed off by maybe, I don't know, National Guard or something, and that there'd been similar attacks maybe into San Francisco. There was something to that effect on the radio broadcast we could overhear. But then that's it. The movie ends with them driving towards, I guess, San Francisco in that tiny, tiny little coupe of a car. They have four humans shoved in that thing, and it has a canvas top. Yeah. And I'm just like, what? How are you really going to make it out of there with a canvas top little, I don't know. Anyhow, so we're left with
questions.
Why did
they take those lovebirds with them?
Yeah, and they took the lovebirds. The lovebird. That is a crazy thing about this movie, and it adds to the tension of it. They have those two lovebirds in a little gilded cage, and they never try to attack anyone. And the little girl, Mitch's little sister Kathy, is adamant, like, they haven't hurt anybody. We can't leave them here. We have to take them with us. So as they're fleeing Bodega Bay, they cram into that tiny car with a cage of two little birds.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We're definitely left with more questions than we are answers.
Right. But for some reason, it's all okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me.
Oh, no. I actually like it. I like that it leaves everything open-ended. Because you just... It's infuriating, but in a good way. Like, you're like, oh, I want to know. Like, what happened? But it's almost like Hitchcock is for... It's like a choose-your-own-adventure. Like, Hitchcock wants you to think about what could have happened or what would happen next or how would you write the ending to this story?
Yeah.
You know, and why was the mom so spooky and why did she have such a hold over Mitch's life? And why did Tippi Hedren's character, Melanie, need to chase after this guy that she just randomly bumped into in a pet? You know, like there's so many questions and we could analyze almost every scene of this movie and probably come up with 10 questions per scene, right?
For sure.
And I think Hitchcock was totally intentional with that.
Yeah, I imagine so. So we've mentioned the cast. Why don't we go ahead and just read through it real quick? Because we probably should have started with that, but, you know, we're just shooting from the hip a little bit.
Shooting from the hip here.
So Rod Taylor plays Mitch Brenner. He's a lawyer. Of course, Rod, I know him best from The Time Machine.
Oh, right. Okay.
When I see his face, I think of the time traveler. He's the time machine guy.
Okay.
Tippi Hedren, this was her first really big gig as an actress. She'd been a model previously.
Oh, right.
She had a crash course in acting from Hitchcock and his whole team.
Just to be in this movie.
for this movie and then the next movie that she was in.
Okay.
Of course, she's written some pretty negative comments about Hitchcock during this era. I don't think we're going to get into that too much.
Yeah.
We're not really a gossip podcast.
But, you know, everybody's human and makes mistakes.
But yeah.
I wasn't there, so I can't speak to his mistakes.
Yeah, we'll get into her in a second here. And then Jessica Tandy, we mentioned, plays Mitch's mom, Lydia.
Uh-huh.
And then Veronica Cartwright plays the little girl, Kathy, which is Mitch's sister. And then Suzanne Pleshette plays Annie Hayworth, like you mentioned. It's funny because she's young and beautiful and,
Very striking. I love Suzanne Pleshette's look. She just looks very, almost like Elizabeth Taylor-esque, but like the next door version of
her.
Oh,
yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
But in this film, she kind of plays like used, washed up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, discarded.
She's Mitch Brenner's cast off. One of many, it was the way it sounded when the, you know, if you listen to her conversations.
And we talked about Suzanne Pleshette earlier this year when we did Blackbeard's Ghost.
That's right. And she's in one of my favorite kid movies, The Ugly Dachshund.
That is a good one.
I think Disney must have liked to use Suzanne Pleshette a lot.
Uh-huh.
She had that, you know who else she reminds me of is Annette Funicello. That was another common face in that kind of classic that Disney era.
Yeah, for sure. So let's go through some standouts.
All right.
I'll get us started. Well, one thing that makes this film super special is how Hitchcock keeps you on edge the whole time. And I want to call out that scene specifically in the diner when you have all these things going on. You have Tippi Hedren basically going on about the attack that happened at the schoolyard. You have all this general noise, things happening that would happen in a diner.
But no music, just noise.
All this noise. You have a lady that comes out that's supposedly some sort of bird expert. She's saying, oh, that couldn't have happened. Birds don't behave that way.
Right.
You know, and she's saying all the things that we know to be true about birds.
Right.
But she's communicating that very frankly and dismissive of anything Melanie says.
She's almost upset that they're, you know, defaming the birds, you know, blaspheming the birds.
Right.
She's mad about it, you know, like, don't say, you know, humans are the problem. Don't talk bad about the birds.
Exactly. You have this bum that's just hanging out at the bar that's occasionally shouting out, the end is near.
Yeah, he quotes random scriptures and, you know, like, you know, quintessential drunk on the street corner, you know, doomsday preacher kind of guy.
And it's just kind of annoying. And then you have this lady with a couple kids at a table, very distressed, is like telling her waitress, can you please ask them to keep it down? They're really frightening the children and, and myself. And so that's adding to the tension as well.
Right.
And you know, there's this buildup happening. The movie's called The Birds. We just saw this horrible attack.
Yeah, the birds were just literally minutes ago attacking a whole school full of children as they ran for safety, right?
Yeah. So it's like, hey, will you listen to Melanie? She knows what she's talking about.
And there's like a sea captain type guy that happens to be in the diner too. And
he's
like, hey, one of my boats got attacked by birds last week or, you know, something. Like he's kind of pitching in saying, no, she might know what she's talking about.
Yeah. And the bartender is really feeding into it. He wants to know all the details.
Right.
So he's the one that's keeping this conversation going.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole scene, that I don't know if it's a 5 minute, 10 minute scene. That whole time, you're definitely on edge.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel yourself getting more and more irritated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting there watching this movie, and I like it a lot, and I'm talking about it. But I was definitely irritated during this scene.
Yeah.
It's like, please, just listen to Melanie.
Because she knows it's like you're in the scene. I think that lack of music laid over the background, it's like you're in that diner. You're one of the diners. Because every one of those diners is getting agitated for their own reasons. And you become one of those diners in that scene. Like, you're just like, oh, somebody do something. Or you shut up and you shut up and let's talk to that person. You know, it's like you're there. It's very surreal.
Yeah. Agreed. Next standout, the cinematography. So 1960, Psycho was in black and white. And just this was 3 years later. The colors are just so vibrant and bold, and the contrast is high. And it's just gorgeous to look at.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. Which we've talked about a lot. You love that Hammer horror saturation. And this has a very similar saturation, I think.
Exactly. So, yeah, I definitely am drawn to that early 60s look. And Hitchcock, I mean, the cinematography, whoever he used, It was really nice.
It was beautiful. I noticed something when we were researching on this. I saw photos of the film, and they were in black and white. And I was like, wait, didn't we just watch this in color? Why are these? And you were saying there's something, they went back later and did a black and white photo shoot. Was there a reason for that?
Oh, yeah. I don't know why they did it in black and white, but probably for a magazine or something.
Oh, something that they needed black and white spread, yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Huh. Publicity photos.
Yeah, it was
interesting.
It was just confusing to me because I'm like, I know I've seen this movie multiple times in color. Why am I seeing these pictures in black and white? So I was like, was it colorized? But it wasn't. You're saying it was actually filmed.
Right, because they were talking about the birds that were on Hitchcock weren't even in the film.
Oh, okay.
So it was done for publicity.
Hitchcock. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, since we're talking about kind of the beauty of the cinematography, I'll pile on and say the setting is a standout for me. I've never been to San Francisco. You have. But we only get to see like a teeny snippet of San Francisco and not even much of kind of greater San Francisco. You're kind of zoomed in to the pet store and the apartment building. But then when we go out to Bodega Bay, like the vista becomes this wide sweeping view.
Yeah.
And anytime I see a setting like that in a movie, I'm instantly like, does that really exist? I want to see it. Like, that's so pretty.
Let's find a bed and breakfast out there.
Right. Like, does that town exist? So I did look it up, and Bodega Bay does exist. It's a real town. I think north of San Francisco. I might be wrong. I'm not a California girl. I don't know. But it's really there. And I looked at their like modern day 2022 tourism board kind of website. And it looks pretty similar to what it looks like in the movie. So I don't know if they've done a really, maybe, I don't know if real estate's crazy expensive there and nobody can move there, or they're just really good at marketing their town. But it almost looks indistinguishable from the Bodega Bay you see in the movie. And I'm like, well, that was 1963. This is 2022. It's quite a few years have passed. So maybe they've kept it historically. I don't know. But it still looks like a very pretty town. And I think it adds to that tension we keep talking about in this movie, because it's such a peaceful kind of harborside town. It's not a bustling port city. It's like just a little quiet harbor. You know, a few little fishing captains probably live and work there. And everybody else is like small farmer or just a little townsperson.
Right.
You have a tiny school with one school teacher. I doubt that's how it is present day.
Right.
But that's how it is pictured in the 1963 movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it just is picturesque. And I think that adds to just that element of horror and shock when these birds just go ballistic on everybody.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. We definitely have to go there someday.
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should. I still would like to see San Francisco sometime. So, you know.
Yeah.
If it's only 2 hours away, why not? And then the other standout I wanted to hit on was the bird effects. These are legit birds. These are not, I mean, I'm sure there's puppets in there somewhere, but the close-ups you see and the actual, like, active footage of birds attacking, those are real birds, real live birds. I don't even know if you can film that. I don't know. I haven't heard any PETA complaints about Alfred Hitchcock.
I thought that when Mitch, you know, was trying to, during one of the invasions in the home.
Right.
Yeah, the bird was coming through. I think it was like a big pigeon, maybe, or a
seagull.
It was a seagull.
They
That's
were
what
seagulls,
it was.
Yeah.
And he was like pushing on the bird pretty aggressively, like trying to cram it out.
I think he even like caught it, like it was in his hand at one point. He like throws it out. The birds had worked their way past the shutters or something they had on the outside of the window.
Yeah, and he's trying to shut the shutter.
Reach through a broken window and pull a shutter closed, and the bird's like pecking his hand.
Yeah.
And we still have that like Crayola red kind of fake blood look. But it looked like a real bird was going after his hand.
Yeah. He was like wrestling with this bird. Like, we're watching it. And again, I don't know if PETA would be okay with that today.
I don't know. I don't know how they filmed it. I don't know if birds were harmed. I hope they were not. But it was very effective filmmaking.
Very convincing.
Right.
Because it was also a large seagull. I mean, you realize, like, you see seagulls on the beach and stuff, and you don't really think about them. What if they all turned on me and attacked me?
Right, yeah.
But
well,
even one was pretty big.
We're Floridians, so we do have some seagull issues. You never leave your sandwich unattended at the beach, or your Cheetos, or anything.
They'll take your food from you.
They will
sure.
come and
Bullies.
Snatch it straight out of your hand. I heard a news report, some random thing recently, that I think somewhere in Venice, Italy, I think it was Venice, there's a cafe that's arming their patrons with, I think there are water guns or something, because the seagulls are getting so bad that, you know, it has all this little Italian cafe with outdoor seating, and the seagulls are so bad there that they're arming the patrons with some sort of like water guns or something to scare them off. I did read somewhere that there were like 3,200 birds trained for this movie. So there are legit real birds in this movie. And they made a note, I think Hitchcock noted, that the ravens in the movie were the cleverest of the birds.
Okay.
So that's pretty interesting.
Wow. Yeah. But one last standout, just all the iconic scenes.
Yeah.
And I think when you think of a Hitchcock movie, name one, and instantly three or four scenes come to mind.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that speaks to, obviously, the cinematography, the direction of the film, mm-hmm. the buildup that it took to get to that moment, that this moment sticks out in your mind.
Yeah. Well, I think that's vision, right? That's the director's vision. Like, Hitchcock mm-hmm. saw the big picture. I'm thinking, is it North by Northwest where the guy's running through the field and the plane's chasing him? Like,
exactly.
You're like, I can't think of a Hitchcock film that doesn't have at least one iconic scene where like you tie that scene directly when you hear of that scene when you think of the title.
Yeah.
So I think that's just part of his grand vision. He had a big picture
mm-hmm.
for what was going to happen in these films.
Yeah. And so some of those big moments we've already mentioned, and this kind of plays to the whole keeping you on edge, that scene where Melanie's seated at the bench outside of the school playground.
Right.
And there's just a couple birds there. And she's like fumbling through her purse.
Like she's looking for a cigarette or something.
She's looking for a cigarette. Meanwhile, like she's waiting on the little girl to come out of the schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep singing this really annoying song.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
They sing like 84 verses. This horrible song.
Yeah.
And it adds to the tension. And they keep cutting back over and showing like, well, now there's 10 birds.
Uh-huh.
And she's still fumbling through her purse. And you hear these kids singing again. Now there's like 20 birds.
It's behind her. She's completely unaware of what's amassing behind her.
Yeah. And you just feel yourself tense. Like,
turn around.
Look around, you know? Yeah. And finally we get that. She turns around, sees the birds, goes inside, you know, and then, you know, everything kind of breaks out after that.
Well, and it was like at the pivotal moment because I think the kids were singing their verses so they could go out to recess. So Annie Haywood is about to release all the kids to the playground at the last second. Tippi Hedren's character, I just lost her name. Melanie goes inside and says, no, don't let him out. Don't let him out. Don't let him go outside. Because she's like, look. And then she takes her. And I love that she doesn't. There's just such a conservatism of dialogue here. She doesn't say, like, there's a bajillion birds outside. I'll go outside. Like, she's like, don't let the kids out. And then walks her to the window and shows her, like, there's 40,000 birds on your playground equipment. Don't send the kids out.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have to say any of it. It's all done with the cinematography. So, again, back to that kudos to the cinematography.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, we talked about the scenes where the birds were chasing the kids down the road, you know, being stuck in the phone booth, the old man with his eyes poked out. Those are all iconic scenes. But there's another one where Melanie hears a sound. This is right after the huge attack that happened on the house.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the middle of the night, and the attack kind of died down, and she hears something upstairs. And everybody else is asleep. And it reminded me of Black Sabbath, the movie that we watched.
Oh, yeah.
Where I can't remember the girl's name.
She goes outside in the dark by herself. Is that where you're going
with
that?
She goes outside. She doesn't wake up the boyfriend that just saved her.
Nope.
She wants to go outside and check out the situation by herself. That's exactly what Melanie does. She goes upstairs. And it was like the instant she opened the door, the birds start attacking her. The door shuts. And she's falling helplessly on the ground while she's just getting inundated. All these pecks over and over and over again. It's so awful and graphic because they're showing you the bird like peck at her skin, and like tug at it, like bite at her skin. Yeah. And it just, the scene, I don't know how long it went on. Maybe it was only 30 seconds.
It felt like forever.
It did feel like forever. But that scene, that was one of the ones that just sticks with you.
Yeah, because she like, the door opens to the inside of the room and somehow she gets in the room and then the birds start attacking her and she shuts the door behind herself, basically.
Yeah.
And then she's trying to get it open and keeps re-shutting, like getting the door cracked open and then re-shuts it again with all these birds flapping around. It's so infuriating. It's just maddening.
And then she faints or is overcome by the power of the birds. I don't know, but she's kind of out of it.
By the power of the birds.
And Mitch is trying to get in, remember? And he's like, for some reason, he can't push the door open.
Her body is against the door now.
Right.
Yeah, so he can't. And I don't know, it's an old farmhouse. It was a big, heavy wooden door, and now it has a, you know, the she's dead blocking. Weight of a passed out, fully grown woman against it. So, I mean, sure, it was probably hard to open the door.
So, yeah, he couldn't open the door, and all this is happening. And you're like, hurry, Mitch, hurry, save her.
Yeah. You kind of want to be at some point like, oh, she's a goner, right? Like,
yeah.
There's no way. But she's not. He does rescue her, get her out of there. And she's clearly like a little baddie at that point. Like, I don't know. She's not, I mean, she really only has flesh wounds, right?
Yeah.
But she's mentally, I think she's had it. She's in shock or something.
I think she's in a state of shock.
Yeah.
That's what they use as the device to make them leave the house. They got to figure out, well, you know, because he even says she needs to see a doctor.
Right.
You and I were both like, I think she's fine. Like, let's just hang out here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think she has internal damage from pecs from a seagull, right? Like, maybe she needs a rabies shot or something. I don't know. Do birds carry rabies? Bats can. I don't know if birds can, but I don't know. Well, let's jump into setbacks then.
Sure.
And I'm going to not go hard after bad decision-making because that would we would just have to bash every horror film, I think, right?
Correct.
That's what I'm learning. But there is some overacting. So I, of course it was a stupid decision to be the only one awake in the house, hear fluttering sounds and go try and see what it is because we know it's a bird. It's a bird, lady. Come on. Anyhow. But, I do think there was just some physical overacting in that scene. Maybe not so much because I mean, she is being attacked by a room full of birds that have, I guess, come in through the attic or something.
They pecked a hole in the roof, maybe. Something.
Yeah. But earlier, before everything had kind of calmed down, when the massive attack was happening on the farmhouse, and we have Mitch and Lydia and Kathy and Melanie all trapped in Mitch's mother's house, there's just, you're getting that buildup, again, with no music causing the buildup. It's just the sound of the birds amassing outside and flying against the doors and pecking at windows and that sort of thing. And nothing is happening to the humans inside. They're just freaking out because, like, what are we going to do if they break through our defenses? And there's just, like, this, like, Melanie kind of, like, throws herself against a wall and, like, rolls along the wall.
Yeah, and like, Lydia smashes against a lamp or something.
Yeah, and then Lydia, like, grabs little Kathy. I say little. She's, like, a preteen, but, you know, she's the little sister. And, like, keeps moving her around the room like they're going to escape the birds that aren't in the room. That was a little over the top, I felt like. I don't know what they should have been doing during that moment, and I don't know what I would have been doing if my whole house was being dive bombed by a million birds, but it felt a little over the top for me.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a little annoying that Mitch was the only one doing anything.
Right.
And they're all like, I don't know, writhing in pain against the wall, even though
they're
not being
attacked.
Yeah, writhing
in pain even though they haven't been attacked yet. Exactly. That's, I'm like, what are you doing?
And he's like, oh no, you know, there's a bird coming through, the seagull coming in through the window. I need to fix this.
Right.
And he's taking action.
He's moving furniture in front of windows and nailing things up and boarding up, you know, fireplaces. And they're just like rolling around the room.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a little annoying.
So that's my one setback, I think.
So, yeah, I praise the cinematography, but they did one effect that annoyed me. It annoyed me in the original Star Trek TV series too.
Oh yeah.
Anytime they show a close up of a beautiful woman's face, they do this fuzzy effect. It's like a glow effect.
Mm-hmm. We call that a filter in the Instagrams.
Yeah, it looks like an Instagram filter. It's weird because it like smudges out all wrinkles. You know, it makes her face glow.
That would be really weird.
Like Pinocchio effect. But I think it's supposed to make you feel like, oh, they're so beautiful, you know?
Yeah, it's like they're ethereal or something.
But I guess the techie side of me hated it because it made the quality of the picture worse.
Yeah.
Because they would show Mitch and you would see every pixel in perfection with all this great color.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's got wrinkles. I mean, but he looks like a man.
Looks like a human. Right.
Then they show Tippi Hedren and it was like all this soft glow and the screen becomes a little fuzzy.
Like she just stepped out of Rivendell or somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I hated that effect. And anytime they did a close-up of her, they did that for her.
Yeah, that was strange.
It was a stylistic choice. And again, who am I to question Hitchcock? But today, you know, watching it, I didn't like that. It took me out of it a little bit, because again, it wasn't consistent with the rest of the filming of the picture.
Right. So now I'm curious, because I don't know that I've picked up on that on other Hitchcock films. Has he done that with other female leads in his other films?
That's a good question.
I'm thinking it's particularly Vertigo, because they're, you know, Jimmy Stewart's character has such a fascination with the woman who goes up to this building every day. Like, I wonder if she gets that glow effect too. I don't remember it, but
I know they did some things with colors. They did like a green glow at one point.
Right.
Remember that?
Right. And it had to do with the colors even that they wore.
Yeah.
In their costuming.
We'd have to go back and watch it and see.
Yeah. I'm curious if that's a Hitchcock thing, or was it just for this movie he decided to do that? I don't know.
Right. But yeah. That's pretty much it for me for setbacks, too.
No, overall, it's a standout movie, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that brings us to yay or nay, what say you, Kim?
Well, I say yay. We know very well that I'm not the horror or sci-fi buff here. But this is one, a horror movie that, if it's called a horror movie, I think it is right? Yeah. That I can get behind. I see the validity in like all of its accolades. It's a classic. It's set the standard for so many horror movies, especially I think animal horror movies to come after it. Mm-hmm. And Hitchcock was just a mastermind of innovation, just to the choice to not have music in the background. Mm-hmm. And just the tension and the buildup and the slow storytelling. It's a masterpiece. So it's definitely a yay for me.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm right there with you. Same reasons you just said, the slow buildup. And I guess I would recommend watching half the film, stopping it.
Yeah.
Take it, you know, just soak up. Think about what you just witnessed and then watch the second half. Because otherwise, if you just watch the film straight through, you're only going to really think about or reflect on the second half, all those attack scenes.
Right, exactly.
And I think this is where a lot of movies get it wrong. And I think, you know, we're not here to judge Jaws at this point, but that's another reason why, like, Jaws is also a classic. You know, you think of so much of the shark attack scenes,
right,
in the last 45 minutes to 60 mm-hmm. minutes. But really, that first 60 minutes is what really sets you up for that.
Yeah, it's when they're telling the story, really.
Yeah. And you get invested in these characters. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I don't want them to die.
Right. You know? Well, I want to figure out why this woman chased this man 2 hours away from San Francisco. Like, what's the draw here?
Right? Yeah. Yeah, and why is mom so freaked out about her son having a relationship?
Right, yeah, why is she so controlling?
Or is she like 35 years old? Yeah, or is she...
Yeah.
Was it all made up by Annie?
We don't know.
And then how did Annie get killed by those birds?
That's right. We didn't even talk about poor Annie. We find her dead on the steps, which I do think little sister Kathy explained that, right? Like, she heard something, she went out on the porch... Yeah. And she shoved Kathy back in the house, but it was too late. The birds had taken, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyhow, yeah, that was another question.
Yeah.
Left a bit unanswered.
But yeah, so it's a yay for me. Definitely watch it. It's one that you can watch with your family if you want to introduce them to horror.
Yeah.
And I do like this idea of nature versus man. There's a few other movies out there that have done this. You know, any of these animal attack movies, there's a bunch of lists out there. And I was just curious. Yeah. So I was looking at them. Jaws and the birds are always number one and two.
Oh, yeah. Cream of the crop right there.
Yeah. And there's a pretty big drop off after that. So I'll throw out some other movies. Then we might review some of these.
Okay.
So we won't go into depth on these. But Cujo from 1983.
It's a scary dog, right?
Big scary dog.
I don't think I ever saw that.
Arachnophobia, 1990.
I definitely did see that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hate spiders.
And that's another, I think, horror comedy.
It is. There's definitely a lot of comedic elements in that
one. Yeah. Piranha, 1978.
Yeah, I had an uncle that let me watch that at a very impressionable age.
Yeah,
not
maybe
a
nightmares
good time.
From what you've told me.
Yeah, I had some recurring nightmares from that.
Orca, 1977. Of course, they're cashing in on the Jaws success. Lake Placid, 1999.
Have I seen that? I don't think I've seen that.
I don't know if you saw that. Big killer alligator, I think. Anaconda, 1997.
J-Lo. I definitely saw that.
Yeah, I saw that one in the theater.
That's a horror comedy too, right?
Yeah, like yeah,
there's
for
some
sure.
comedic silliness there. So what about Snakes on a Plane?
Oh yeah, there's another one.
I haven't seen that either, but I've seen enough clips to feel like I've seen it.
Well, there's that huge drop-off from Jaws and the Birds to these films, I would say. Now, some of them could be argued that they're up there, too. But then there's another big drop off because lately, like the last 10 or 15 years, like the sci-fi channel movies.
Oh, right.
You get like Sharknado and the octopus, I don't know, Octomonster versus.
Oh, I don't even know that. Wasn't there something like the Megalodon or something? The
any variation you can think of. Three-headed shark versus the.
I mean, Austin Powers had his ill-tempered sea bass, right? So there you go.
So I think that's the direction that's got, you know, these animal attack movies have gone. They've gone pretty absurd.
Yeah, for sure.
A couple comments on this film from our Instagram followers. The film theorists, our buddy Steve and Chloe, said, "The very first Hitchcock I saw this on TV in the mid-70s when I was about 10, and it scared the bejesus out of me. I now own a nice Hitchcock box DVD set and have watched it recently. Still a great horror film." Mm-hmm. And Yak Blah dad gum blah.
What?
Don't make me say that again.
Okay.
Just said good times! ! And I think there were some other comments in our story. Time expired, and I have lost those comments. So I do apologize if you commented, and I've now lost.
Wait. Let's do some crowdsourcing here. We are not Instagram techies, so if there's a way for Jeff to retrieve those comments, why don't you DM him and let him know?
Please do. All right, before we talk about our next film, there is a programming note I want to mention. Our podcast is going to move from being a weekly podcast to bi-weekly, meaning every other week.
Not twice a week. We're barely hanging on now as it is.
But we figure we'll still have the same number of episodes per season, which is 21. And that way, more of the year is covered that way. And so, you know, you can enjoy Attack of the 20th Century over a course of 42 weeks instead of just 21 weeks.
Oh, okay. And hopefully that'll help the family scheduling constant snafus.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Because at this point, like we just experienced, when we get sick, like we're just out and we have to postpone.
Right, exactly.
And hopefully we're not sick for 2 weeks straight, because that's a pretty bad 2 weeks then.
Yeah, I'm over it for sure.
All right, so then what are we watching 2 weeks from now?
All right, so 2 weeks from now, we are going to watch Q, The Winged Serpent. This is a 1982 sci-fi horror. It is rated R. Here, there's some language in it, so take note. Currently, it is free on Pluto TV. All right, I know nothing about this film except for a small blurb from Rotten Tomatoes that tells us that a gangland flunky, played by Michael Moriarty, finds the New York nest of an ancient Aztec deity that starts with a Q that I'm not going to try and pronounce. Probably why the movie is aptly named Q.
Q. The winged serpent.
And apparently Q is a man-eating flying serpent.
Yes. So another attack from above film.
Right.
We figure after the birds, we'll switch it up. We'll have a winged serpent coming down and attacking people.
So it went from real birds to fantastical ancient Aztec deity flying serpents. Okay.
Yeah. I think this is one we're going to have fun with.
Right.
And the other thing is we're back to 1982.
We're back in 1982. That's a good year for us for some reason. Or maybe it's a bad year. I don't know. We'll see.
And there's so many good movies from 82 that we haven't done yet.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to save some for season 3 and 4.
So. Right. 82 was a year.
All right. Well, that does it for us. Have a great week.
Enjoy your movies, guys. Peace out.
Peace out.